Didn't have a second position.
He didn't have.
Okay, good morning. We'll call to order the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement for July 8, 2010. We don't yet have an administrative quorum, so we won't be able to act on the commission minutes yet. We have a number of presentations to be made to the Pensions Commission by our consulting actuary and by the affected fund. So we'll start with number two on the agenda, review of the 2004-2008 experience study reports of MSRS, PERA, and TRA. And we're going to start with a presentation by the commission's reviewing actuary, Milliman, Inc. Welcome back to the commission. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. Good morning, members of the commission. My name is Patrice Beckham. I'm with the firm of Milliman out of the Omaha office.
Good morning. William Hogan from Milliman out of the Milwaukee office.
Welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be here on such a beautiful summer day. Hopefully you all have a copy of our hard copy of the PowerPoint presentation that discusses our review of the experience studies for the three large funds. That's what we'll use for our discussion this morning. Please feel free to stop us anytime during the presentation if you have questions or would like to make comments. That would be great. So on slide number two, we thought it would be important just to kind of start with a high overview. You're aware that actuarial evaluations are prepared annually for each of the funds. Those evaluations are prepared to assess the financial status of the plans and to calculate actuarial contribution rates and compare those to the fixed contribution rates. A very important part of that process is projecting future benefit payments. That's what's driving the liabilities of the system. Those future benefit payments are an unknown because they're contingent on so many different future events. Actuaries use assumptions to try to anticipate what will happen, when payments will start, how long they'll be made, what those amounts will be. And that's why it's so important that the actuarial assumptions are reasonable and our best estimates of the future. We obviously don't know what's going to happen in the next 30 to 50 years, or we'd probably be lying on a beach in the Caribbean, but we're going to give it our best shot. And we do appreciate the effort and the additional information that Mercer, as a retained actuary, provided to us for our analysis.
And I read through the broader report, but basically these assumptions are brought into two categories. One is economic and one is demographic, correct?
Correct, Senator.
Okay, and we got various subcategories on it. Okay, go ahead.
Right. Yeah. I did want to mention, because a few things have changed since the report was issued in June. We have some conversations, again, with the retained actuary, Mercer, and with the fund directors last week to kind of describe some of our concerns about the assumptions. And we were able to come to consensus about a set of assumptions that we're all comfortable with. So that's the set that we're assuming that we're moving forward with.
Which doesn't mean you're all right. It just means that you're all in agreement.
That's right.
Okay.
On slide three, an experience study is involves an incredible amount of work and a lot of number crunching. We did not replicate that process. We essentially relied on Mercer's calculations to be accurate, which is typically when there's an actuarial audit or review of an experience study, that's what typically happens. We did do some independent verification of the membership counts. We call that exposure. We're studying retirement, you know, how many people were age 55, 56, 57. We did some independent verification of the exposure, and we're very comfortable with those results. We tried to do the same with the number of people that were changing status. So if we're studying retirement, how many people actually retired at that age in each year? That was more difficult because the reconciliation that's in the valuation report, that information comes from the fund, not from Mercer. And in the experience study, Mercer actually was comparing data on two consecutive measurements periods, and that's how they identified their decrements. So we weren't able to really verify that. Again, we relied on Mercer's calculations as far as the accuracy. We often like to look back at the prior experience study, what happened in that study period compared to what happened in this period. Does that make sense? Do we see trends? You know, that influences whether we think there should be changes. There were several situations where there were dramatic changes in the results of this study compared to the prior one, and there really was just insufficient detail in the old study to be able to reconcile it or get any insight into it. On most of those, we're kind of staying the course and not making a change or making a modest change, if any, for those assumptions. So slide 4. In addition to reviewing the assumptions, we also take the opportunity when an experience study is done to review all the actuarial methods that are used. So that's the actuarial cost method, the asset valuation or asset smoothing method, and the amortization method. And Mercer recommended maintaining the current methodology. We agree with that. I think there are two areas that might warrant further discussion or study if they're of interest. One has to do with the asset valuation method. And again, we're not recommending a change to the basic methodology, but there's something called a corridor that some systems use. We're going to talk about that in a minute and show you an example. The other one is on how you amortize your unfunded actuarial liability. Right now, it's recalculated each year, and there's just what we would call one base, one amount that has to be spread. And it's spread over whatever the remaining years are in the amortization period. There are different ways to approach that, and we think it might be worth some additional study to see if a different methodology might produce more stability in the contribution rates. That's kind of beyond the scope of this review and might really be more appropriate for the retained actuaries to take a look at that. But again, as we go through this, we just kind of throw out ideas that might be of interest and that might result in an improvement in the stability of the contribution rate. That's always the concern.
So we're just trying to figure out if the recent years are an aberration or if it's going to be the norm from here on out.
I think on this one, Senator, it's more, is there a different methodology, given the volatility that exists in on the asset side in particular, but also the liability side, is there a way to finance that UAL in a different method that might produce more stability in the contribution rate? One problem with a closed period, which you have where you say, whatever the unfunded liability is, we're going to pay it off by 2020. Well, as you get closer to 2020, you have a very short period of time to pay that off, and your contribution rate will be greatly impacted if you have large gains or losses. What typically happens is you get close, and then you say, well, we're going to re-amortize, and we'll push it out, you know, another 20 years. There are ways where the basic methodology always has kind of a staggered schedule, and that's the option that we think might be worth looking at. Okay. So slide 5, a little bit more on the corridor. Just a refresher, in the valuation process, an asset valuation or asset smoothing method is used to try to kind of balance out or smooth out the peaks and valleys that occur in market value. The volatility in the market value of assets will translate directly to volatility in the contribution rates unless there's some mechanism in place to try to smooth some of that out. So that's why we use an asset smoothing method. The corridor has been added by some systems to make sure that the actuarial value of assets doesn't stray too far from the true market value. And the most common corridor is 80% of market to 120. So you do your regular calculation for actuarial value, but after you have your answer, you test it and say, is it more than 120% of market or less than 80%? And if it is, you mark it back. You make it the actuarial value equal to that. Now, The corridor has been around a long time. It's been in the code for corporate defined benefit plans since ERISA in 1974. And in the corporate side, if you use that smoothing, you absolutely have to use a corridor. Public sector, you don't have to. We think about half of the systems do and half don't. So there isn't really a prevalent trend there. But if – oh, I know what I wanted to say – Historically, at least in the 25 years I've been doing this, we haven't seen corridors kick in. In other words, it hasn't really mattered whether you had a corridor or not. You just did your regular calculation, and that value almost always fell between 80 and 120% of market. Well, calendar year 2008 and fiscal 2009 had a very different result. And a lot of the systems that had corridors, that 120% kicked in. And what happens is when you have to mark your actuarial value, it would have been higher. Now you're going to set it at 120. You're going to recognize more of the loss than the regular smoothing would have. Okay? And that's kind of the issue with the corridor. You know, where's the value? If the fluctuations are sort of typical asset fluctuations, so they're bounce, it's up, it's down, it's up, it's down, then probably the corridor isn't as valuable because it's going to fight against the smoothing method. It's not going to be as smooth as just letting the method do its thing and you recognize that gain and loss over 5 years. If the change in the asset value is more of a correction, where it's down, it's going to stay down, then the corridor probably has more value. Mercer did bring that up in their experience study. They did not have a specific recommendation other than I believe they said that they thought it was worth studying the corridor. It's a lot more important when the employer is contributing the actuarial rate. A fixed rate, it isn't as critical because the rate might be higher, but you know what you're putting in. But, and you have if you look on slide 6, this is a client that we had, and they do contribute the actuarial rate. And if you look at the red line, that was the employer contribution rate, just letting the smoothing method operate the way it normally does, without a corridor. And you can see it's a significant increase in the contribution rate, but fairly equal amount each year and certainly more systematic. So there was time to plan ahead to let employers know. The blue line was with the application of the 120% of market limit and the corridor. So again, it shoves more of that loss into that first year, and you can see that the rate for the 12/31/08 valuation was significantly higher with the corridor. In this particular situation, the board actually voted to lift the corridor for that 1 year and go with the red line because it was such a dramatic increase in the contribution rate. Again, this can be modeled, you know, for your funds to see what the impact is. But it has come up, I think, in the past, and we thought that it was something we should bring to your attention. Again, to the extent that the assets are fluctuating and we have the lows and the highs, we don't particularly think a corridor is necessary. You're going to recognize experience over 5 years, which is a relatively short period. Questions on corridors? Might be kind of a new topic for you guys. Oh, okay. Slide 7. All of the systems use a load, which simply means a percent increase is applied to their liabilities, to anticipate the fact that there are members that have service in multiple systems, and the combined service annuity rules are going to impact the final benefit, and it will be higher than what their own data would anticipate. There was no analysis in this experience study nor in the prior study on the combined service rules. And Bill might know more than I do on this. It's my understanding that this has kind of been an issue for years in that it's just hard to get the data to do the analysis. No one entity has all the data to do the study. But we think that it would be a good idea to gather that data and analyze it and make sure that that load is still appropriate, because it appears that it's been maybe a decade at least since that has been looked at. So that's one recommendation coming out of our review, is that combined service annuity load be evaluated. And I think that would require some additional work. Any questions? All right. Slide 8. Senator Betzel said, we really kind of classify assumptions into two categories, economic assumptions and demographic assumptions. Pretty clearly, the economic assumptions are related to what's going on in the economy as a whole, the global economy. The demographic assumptions are specific to the membership of the funds and what's happening here within those plans. When we talk about selecting assumptions, we have to be very, very honest. It's the number crunching part of it is definitely science, but interpreting the results, evaluating, and making recommendations is a little bit more art than science. So it is subjective. We're all influenced by our own experience, and everybody has a little bit different take on what the next 30 to 50 years holds. So it's not unusual to have differences of opinion. And to be quite candid, there's not a right answer because we don't know what the future holds. It's hard enough to predict the next 2 years, let alone the next 30. One of the key factors is really evaluating the observed experience and assigning credibility to that. So in other words, do we think it has a lot of credibility? Are there reasons why what we've observed might not be the true long-term trend? You know, how convinced are we? Do we want to move all the way? Do we want to move part of the way? And I think that's a lot of what happened in the comments when you read in our report. Wasn't critical of any of the work that Mercer did. It was more a difference in philosophy as far as how far to go and how to assign credibility to the observed experience. There's a reasonable range for every one of these assumptions where it might not be where I would set it, but I would still say it's within a reasonable range. I understand why it was set there, and that would have been the case for the assumptions in Mercer's experience study. So slide 9, our general findings. Again, the methodology used for the calculations was certainly mainstream standard actuarial techniques. Recommendations were reasonable. They were justified by the observed experience. If they were changing assumptions, it was based on what was observed, and they were consistent with actuarial practice. Our position was really that, given the funded status of the plans, we think it's prudent to be a little more conservative. We're already in a pretty big, deep hole with the investment experience for the last couple of years, and it's going to be difficult to dig out of that hole. The last thing we really need are experience losses on demographic assumptions. So we would prefer to be a little more conservative, and that would mean anticipating, if anything, higher liabilities than what actually occur, so that we're not, you know, fighting a losing battle, one step forward, two steps back. And I think that, again, is a little bit different mindset maybe than where Mercer was. As I mentioned, we have talked to Mercer and the fund directors about our concerns. They also shared their insight on the changes that they recommended, and they had some good points. We've agreed to revise a set of assumptions, and some of those reflect our desire to be more conservative. And a few of them, we've kind of agreed that the next experience study will do some further analysis and dig into certain features of that. But overall, the new recommended assumptions are more conservative than the initial recommendations in the Mercer study. So I want to make sure you understand that. Okay. So we'll talk first about demographic.
Okay. And Ms. Brinkham, if I can just make sure I understand it. Mercer's approach, they look at the experience studies and try to project forward from that. I think that your approach goes one step beyond that. You try to actually make a more future assumptions, not just based on the experience studies, but on a couple of other factors that you think might be in play down the road, which is why you take more of a conservative approach than just the experience studies would show. I don't know if that's a fair way to state it. But.
Yeah, and I don't know that I should speak for Mercer's, but I would say a lot of the recommended assumptions follow the observed experience very closely. Mm-hmm. Okay, and this gets back, I think, to philosophy. Our approach tends to be okay, we see the experience, particularly coming through an economic period like 2004 to 08. There certainly could be chances that termination of employment or retirement rates were affected by what was happening in the economy. So our approach tends to be, let's move partway towards what was observed, but not all the way, because if that isn't the true long-term trend, you'll have to move back again. So ours is kind of a more gradual approach, and as I said, at least the recommendations for the most part from Mercer were almost dead on to what was actually observed in the study period. Does that make sense?
Yeah, again, you talked about some differences between Mercer. I just want to make sure I understood, you know, where you're coming from, and they can certainly explain where they're at. But now I guess we need to get a more detailed discussion, as I think you're leading to.
Right.
What are the demographic and economic assumptions that we've been relying upon that we may have to be take another look at? Is that what we're going to do?
Correct.
Go ahead.
Correct. Thank you. And we're going to focus today on what I would call the key demographic assumptions. There are a number of secondary assumptions as far as how many members are married and what's their spouse's age difference, and we're not going to get into that. Those were, again, they're kind of not as important when we look at the costs and the liability side of the equation. One of the key measurements that's used in an experience study is something called an AE ratio, and that stands for actual to expected ratio. And it's when we look overall at the experience, what was the fit? Okay. Actual is exactly what it sounds like. Whatever you're studying, retirement, termination, deaths, how many actually occurred during the study period? And the denominator, the E, is the expected, based on the number of people who could have changed status and our actuarial assumption, how many did we think were going to change? And it's that eight actual divided by expected that gives us kind of the overall fit for the current assumption. So if it's 100, we pat ourselves in the back and say we did pretty good. And then we look to see what the distribution looks like, so it's not way high here and way low here, and averages to 100. But if it's higher, so if that AE ratio is 150%, then we're 50% more retirements or terminations, again, whatever we're studying, than we would have expected. And that starts to be a concern because the assumption is not anticipating the experience. Okay, so I want to make sure everybody's comfortable with that measurement, because we're going to look at that AE ratio several times as we look at the different actuarial assumptions. All right, slide 11. Mortality assumption, and we do use a mortality assumption pre-retirement, but the more important assumption is the post-retirement. Since the plans are paying benefits as long as members are alive, mortality is extremely important. So that's going to impact how long we think the payments will be made, and that will directly impact the liabilities. The trend has been for mortality rates to decline in the past. Life expectancy now is better than it was 50 years ago. And although there's some debate on that, the general agreement is that we expect that trend to continue in the future. And our actuarial standards of practice say that we have to specifically consider that, whether we believe that there should be an adjustment for future mortality improvements. There are different ways to address that issue. The traditional approach has really been something that we call creating a margin in the rates, the mortality rates. So we use lower probability of death than what's actually occurring, thinking that over time, that trend, there's going to be fewer deaths, and that'll be a better assumption. When you do that, when you use a margin, you want your actual deaths to be higher than your expected. That's the whole idea. And that good difference thing. Is the margin.
It's a good thing, right?
It depends.
Well, yeah, I mean, from an actuarial standpoint.
From the actuarial perspective.
It's a good thing, yes.
Yes. I often say what's good for the members is not good for the system from an actuarial perspective and vice versa. So, but from an actuarial perspective, if there are more deaths, that is favorable experience. But part of that point is that when you're using that approach, when we then look at AE ratios, we should see them over 100% or the bell start ringing, and we're worried That's a concern. There's another approach that is become more common in probably just the last 5 years, and that's something called generational mortality, which is the old way. There's just one table, one set of factors, one set of probability of death, and that if you're age 65, you look at the table, probability of death, and that's whether you're going to be 65 this year, 10 years from now, 30 years from now. That's the probability of death. The generational mortality is much more sophisticated in that there is a scale that projects improvements in mortality, and the best mortality is then applied to the youngest members. So my daughter's 8. She should have a much lower probability of dying at 65 than I would. And so I like it because it's a much more direct method to project mortality improvements, and the people who should live the longest, it's reflecting it for the younger people, as opposed to using one rate that's lower for everybody. When you use that approach, you set your current mortality rates to fit the experience. So you really are looking for AE ratios around 100%. I don't need a margin anymore because I'm going to take my current mortality rates, and I'm going to project the improvements in future years in each future year, not in this year. And that's kind of a different concept. Make sure everybody's comfortable with that. Again, this is newer and it's more direct, and I think that means better estimates of the liabilities.
Well, okay. The way that our funds are set up right now, I mean, do they all assume that the 55-year-old today who's thinking about retirement is going to have the same life expectancy as the 22-year-old who's just joining? Do they have the same assumption for both of them?
For when they have to reach 55. But if your 22-year-old reaches 55, it'll be the same life expectancy.
We've got two employees in the same system today. Are we making the same assumptions for life expectancy for the 55-year-old as we're making for the 22-year-old, even though we recognize the 22-year-old is probably going to have a longer life expectancy than the 55-year-old currently in the system? So two employees, different ages, so.
Right. Assuming, I mean, the 22-year-old has to get to 55.
Understand, yeah.
But once they do, yes, the life expectancy would be the same under the current traditional methodology.
But you're suggesting that methodology might have a flaw in it because today's 22-year-old statistically might live longer than today's 55-year-old.
We would expect that if the trend for mortality improvement continues.
Okay.
It should be. There should be more longevity for our younger members. And that's why this generational mortality really gets its arms around that in a very direct manner. Now, it doesn't mean you're never going to have to change mortality assumptions.
Right.
Because, again, we're projecting these things out for 50 years. But hopefully the adjustments are smaller in the future, fine-tuning it as different tables come out. And I do like it. You know, Mercer recommended that approach, and, you know, we definitely concur that that's, in our mind, the preferred method, and it makes a direct assumption as far as future mortality improvements. And I think it's, again, a better estimate of future benefit payments and, therefore, the liabilities of the system.
So this should be an ongoing changing assumption as opposed to every couple of years we say, geez, it looks like people are living 2 or 3 years longer, and let's just make that adjustment then. I mean, we should be constantly looking at that.
Your basic assumption is already taking that into account.
Okay. Right.
That it, as time moves out. Now, you know, the Society of Actuaries might publish another table in 2020, mm-hmm. and we might decide that that's, for 2020, that's a better fit than the RP2000 table with projections to 2020. So we might fine-tune it, but again, it's the improvements that are built into the projection. It's almost like if you do Excel and they have all those tabs,
right.
It's almost like you have a mortality table for every tab based on the year. And so it's again, much more sophisticated way to try to get a better measurement.
Okay,
we beat that to death? All right, slide 12. So here's what the experience was for the three systems under the current assumptions and the proposed assumptions. Under the current assumptions, you can see for PARA, we were below 100%. Okay, so that is a concern. So the fewer deaths than what we would have anticipated. It means people are living longer. Liabilities are likely understated.
And they're all using the same table?
So. No, they really use different tables because often to get a better fit, actuaries use what's called an age set forward or set back, where we will treat a member as if they were older if it's a set forward. So if it's plus two, we treat a 55-year-old as if they had the mortality of a 57-year-old. If it's a setback, if it's a five-year setback, that 55-year-old exhibits the mortality of an age 50. And they each kind of had their own adjustments on the age adjustments. But based on, and those adjustments would have been based on what was observed in experience in prior experience studies. But based on their own assumptions, so that's a good point. You kind of put them all in one table, but they're not all using the same current assumption. But based on what the mortality assumption is, this was the result of the actual number of deaths to the expected number. You can see on the proposed assumption that those are much closer to, right around 100%. And again, with generational mortality, that's what we expect. That's what we want to do. We want the current rates to fit the current members. We'll let the projection scale take care of improvements in future years. So just in general, on the next slide, the general trend was mortality improvement in the study. Mercer did recommend going to the RP2000 table, which is a more recent table. And again, it has the projection scale for generational. We concur with them that is a preferred methodology. Our only comment was that we would like in the next experience study to take a close look at the fit of the mortality rates at what we would call the core retirement ages, 60 to 75. We want to make sure we're anticipating the mortality for that group because there's so many people there. And the higher benefit amounts tend to be at the lower ages. So there's a lot of liability that rests in that age range. And we'll study it next time. And then sometimes you might need to make minor adjustments to the mortality rates to get the fit better.
And the purpose of studying that particular group is, well, if they live too long, we got to problems. We have problems, they don't.
Okay. Right. Good for them, not for us. Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
So it all goes back to just trying to, again, get that best estimate of the future benefit payments.
Okay.
All right.
Sarah Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, could you repeat your name again?
It's Beckham. Patrice Beckham.
Beckham?
Beckham.
Ms. Beckham. Are you recommending that we look at the change to the generational mortality rate at this time?
Mercer recommended that change, and we concur with that. We think that would be a favorable change. Most of these plans were using a 1983 group annuity mortality table, so the RP2000 is a more recent table, a table that was prepared specifically for pension valuations, and it has the projection scale for generational. All those are positive factors in our mind. So we are basically concurring with the recommendation that Mercer had in their experience study.
Okay. Representative Tees.
Do we know how much these changes, I'm going to talk about it myself, but how much these changes mean in terms of money ratio?
I do not have that information. Is that readily available?
Not for the last package. We did them earlier, and some assumptions were changed.
Right. That's a very good question. And then the new actuarial standards will include that those be quantified to answer that question.
Okay. Mr. Martin.
I have one question. How graded is the projection on the generational mortality table? How choppy is, if you were to graph it, how choppy is that change? Is it couple of years, 5 years, a decade? What's a generation for purposes of a generational table?
Ms. Beck.
Well, the scale changes based on your age.
But if a 55-year-old today versus a 55-year-old, would it change in five years hence, 10 years hence, 15 years hence? What's the break point, sort of rough hewn way?
The change, members of the commission, the change would be every year. And there's a scale factor that's applied, and so each year this improvement factor is applied to the rates. There's rates for each age, probability of dying, and those rates are reduced each year by a scale that was published along with the table by the Society of Actuaries. And so each and every year that the tables run through the valuation system, it's using a different table at that age for those people. So it's going to continuously improve the mortality rate for the person at that age. When I'm 22, I'm going to get a one-year improvement at 23, a two-year improvement at 24, and so on.
It's kind of gradual.
So it is going to be somewhat gradual that way, yes.
If it would be helpful, we could certainly, you know, when we're back in the office, we could look at it, you know, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years from now, just for informational purposes, if that would be helpful.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it would.
Okay. Please proceed.
Right. The next slide, 14, is looking at the results of the termination of employment assumption. In general terms, if there are more terminations than expected, it's generally favorable experience to the system and lower costs. Now, the termination of employment assumption uses what's called a select and ultimate period. Select just means that the experience or the pattern of termination is different for people in their first 3 years of employment as compared to later years of employment. This is an age-based assumption. So there's a difference in how people behave in the first 3 years. So the 3 years is what's called the select period, and the ultimate is all years after that. Okay. And different assumptions are used for males and females because historically they've exhibited different patterns of termination. And you can see from looking at this that there are a number of situations where the AE ratio is way different than 100%. I mean, 143, 160, 210, those are sort of dramatically different results. And that makes actuaries go, what's going on? Again, when we went back to the last experience study, there really wasn't, I mean, these results are very different. Because if those had been their last study, they would have made changes to bring those AE ratios back closer to 100%. But there really was insufficient detail in that report to draw any kind of conclusions. And where we landed, we kind of flipped to the next slide, that's really our conclusions.
Now, just to be clear, termination would be for any purpose, whether it's retirement, being fired, leaving on your own, just any termination.
Not
right?
Not retirement, Senator.
Not retirement.
Yeah.
Okay.
This would be terminating employment not due to death, disability, or retirement.
Okay.
But voluntary or involuntary, they're in here.
Okay.
Okay.
But it doesn't mean...
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair. Ms. Beckman, but that doesn't mean that they've completed their service and they're old enough to quit now.
When you say old enough to quit,
I mean they
to retire?
Yes.
That's correct. They were not eligible to retire.
Okay, so it's for every other purpose except retirement that they stopped working.
Right. Disability, death, okay.
Yeah, not disability either, but you get the right idea. I mean, it's mostly people that are under 55, so they're not eligible for retirement, early or normal, and they were in one data set, and they're not there the next data set. They left covered employment.
And you're going to go in deeper detail, but a couple of years ago, for instance, PERA had an issue where a lot of the people that used to just pull their money out when they left this government service, And unfortunately, now they were leaving it in, which caused some problems down the road, and that was throwing their numbers off. Is that kind of some of the issues that we're dealing with here? Or?
You know, we are not aware of that, if there was such an issue.
Okay.
It wasn't discussed in the experience
this
study.
This was a couple of years ago from PERA. Okay.
But, I mean, all sorts of data issues can impact these numbers.
Okay. Sarah Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Beckman, you note that you say that there's no explanation for what's behind this, and I don't serve on K-12 any longer, but it seems to me that I'm wondering, and perhaps someone from I'm thinking of TRA in this particular instance, and maybe we'll hear this from the funds later on, but in light of the economic situation that's facing all of our schools all across Minnesota, I think we don't need to look very far than the schools in our own districts, and we've seen a decrease in teaching resources at many districts across the state, and I'm wondering if there's a correlation here.
I think you raise a good point, and we should go back and reiterate that this experience study went from July 1, 2004 to June 30, 2008. Okay, so I'm not saying that didn't happen in that time frame, but I know in the number systems that we work with, we're seeing more of that happen that's happened in the last year or so that wouldn't be captured. So this was experience July 1, 2004 through June 30, 2008. Anything that has happened since is not reflected here, and it'll be captured in the next experience study, which will make evaluating the termination of employment assumption difficult in that study as well. But, yes, I think we're going to see that from a number of states as well.
Okay. Just a clarification. On page 14, with those under ultimate, those were percentages, I take it?
Yes.
Okay, thanks.
Yes, they are.
Yeah, thank you.
So, there were a higher number of terminations than expected. This was probably the one assumption that we couldn't get comfortable with the idea of making a significant change in approach. As Mercer's initial recommendation was a different approach where it would be based on age and service at each duration, not just select and ultimate. And all we had is really the data from this study if we were going to make a change in the assumption. And again, feeling like maybe this data is not representative of a very long-term experience, 20, 30 years, we were probably most uncomfortable with this assumption. And we shared that with Mercer and with the fund directors. And where we ended up was there's no big rush to make a change. We think that it's prudent to let this one ride, wait until the next experience study, again, evaluating what happened during those study periods. But at least at that point, there's 8 years of data. If we want to change the approach with the assumption, we'll be more comfortable doing that when there's more data available. This was definitely one area where we kind of went back and said, we're just going to leave the current assumption in place.
Go ahead, Tease.
Mr. Chair, is this kind of in the range of the assumptions? Is this more or less significant in terms of its impact on the fund?
Well,
Ms. Beckham.
Termination is sometimes a hard one to anticipate exactly how it will impact, especially when you're changing the approach from the select and ultimate to a termination assumption that's totally based on a combination of age and service. I'm trying to remember in the initial, I know that Mercer gave me some initial data on termination. I don't think this particular change was significant. I'm looking to see if Bonnie has give me eye contact. But again, I think our concern was when we have such different results from where we were 4 years ago, it's hard to concur with that. When you didn't do the work, it's not hard for the person that did the work to say, this is what we saw. You know, we crunched the numbers and we really have our arms around it. But as your consultant, you know, red flags kind of went up that this is kind of a big change in approach. If they'd have left the select and ultimate and just lowered it partway, I think we would have been fine with that. It was coming up with a whole new way to establish the assumption that was a concern.
Okay, go ahead.
All right. Well, when we were talking about termination of employment, we said that did not include people who were eligible to retire. Okay, so the next slide talks about, for those who were eligible to retire, what did we observe? In general, if there are fewer people retiring, they're working longer, that's a lower cost. That's positive for the system. When we looked at the AE ratios here, and you'll see it's divided between rule of 90. I'm sure you're aware when you satisfy rule of 90, you can draw unreduced benefits. Okay, and then the non-rule of 90 is got that sort of Social Security retirement age, but not more than 66. What we observed were significantly lower retirements. Despite the fact that in the last experience study, a number of these assumptions were changed, were lowered to create AE ratios close to 100. So same kind of feeling. We definitely observed lower retirements, but is this the trend? Or is this kind of an aberration during the study period? That's always the million-dollar question. In our mind, again, given where the system's funded status is, we thought it made sense to reflect the experience but not move all the way to the observed rates. So the ultimate set of assumptions includes a decrease but not as dramatic as the initial decrease in retirement rates. So we move partway there but not all the way. Then if in the next study period we see retirements come back up, we don't have to move them again in the next study. It's more conservative.
Yeah, my impression had been, although some people could retire at an earlier age, such as under the rule of 90, they may continue working because they need the health care benefits or something like that. Is there anything that we know to back up the numbers? Or this is just the observation you've got that people are working longer than they
This is to. In this four-year period, people were working longer than we expected.
Okay.
In the prior study period, they were working longer, and we reflected that, and now it's even lower than the assumption that we already adjusted lowered. And so that's part of it is, you know, it feels a little strange to just keep lowering them dramatically. Part of it is there are a number of factors at work. When you have multiple employers, sometimes some of those employers may offer retiree medical, some may not. That typically is something that cuts across multiple study periods, though, unless it's an early retirement out, which I think we'll see some of those in the current study period. So, again, as actuaries, we're measuring the experience. We don't always know what's driving that experience. That's part of the difficulty in assigning credibility.
Okay.
Is this a long-term trend? If it stays low again, although, again, the current study period is going to have some very odd economic time issues there, then probably they'll be lowered again. But it's the idea that we don't want to lower them and then they're higher and we got to bounce back. I mean, it's more of a disciplined approach to processing it and moving towards observed experience.
Representative Murphy.
Ms. Beckham, do you mean by lower retirement, do you mean fewer retirements?
Yes, a lower probability of retiring, which translates to fewer retirements. Correct. And so, again, I think this change is more conservative than the initial recommendation. Okay.
Go ahead.
Slide 18. The benefits are related to the final salary that members draw at the end of their career. So we use an assumption for how salaries are going to grow between now and the time that person is assumed to retire. This assumption also, the current assumption, uses that select and ultimate. Okay, it's basically an age-based assumption, but the select period is the first 5 years of employment for MSRS and para, first 10 for TRA. And then the ultimate would be the period after that, right? The observed experience was actually higher during the select period, but lower during the ultimate period. And you can see that the actual numbers on the next slide. Mercer did recommend moving to a pure service-based assumption. Okay, so that means how we assume salaries are going to grow is based on your years of service, independent of age. That's common in public sector, and I think it's very reasonable. Again, part of the problem with making a change in assumptions is you only have this current study period to base it on because we didn't have comparable data from the prior study. So the final assumption actually does have some conservatism built into it. It's slightly higher than the assumption that was in Mercer's experience study. And again, in case we're coming through a period where salaries are perhaps lower, the increases in salary are lower than long term, that'll provide a buffer if that experience turns around in the next study period. So again, this assumption is more conservative.
In trying to project salaries, though, we could very well get to a point a few years from now where the economy is white hot again and booming, and there may be a pressure to catch up. I mean, a lot of the public employees have had 0% increases or very nominal increases in recent years, and so would your assumptions going ahead throw into the possibility that we might have a spike in the salaries to bring them up to where they would have been if we would have had a gradual increase instead of flattening it out?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it definitely happens, mm-hmm. the sort of catch-up. The problem is that, you know, this assumption is going to be used to project salaries over a long period of time, and it might actually be pretty close to right over a 10 to 20-year period, but it may be really, really low up then back down. And the problem is, you know, it's not that precise that we would say, well, the spike is going to happen in 3 years or 5 years. So the idea is over the long term, the projected salaries are pretty close. How it plays out from year to year might vary. And then what will happen is if it's low, 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 high, you'll have gain, 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 loss. I mean, that's just the way the actual evaluation process works, that you're only capturing the experience that's actually happened. But the idea, I think you're right, the idea with the more conservative salary assumption is we could be coming through a period here where salary increases are very low, but over the long term, they're unlikely to stay that low forever, that there will be some kind of pressure to bring those salary rates up. And we do have some conservatism built in for that.
Thank you. Mr. Hogan.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, one other comment I might make on that, too, is that, and Pat's going to get to that in some of the later slides, is part of that is tied to the economic assumptions as well, and that's why it's important, which Pat will be talking about, that the economic assumptions reasonably relate to the salary increase assumption because the long-term impact of future pay increases is probably going to follow the economy to some degree. And so if those two assumptions are in sync, then over a long period of time, the salary increase assumption should probably play out to be pretty reasonable.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
If you would look at slide 20, again, we sort of had a fundamental change in the approach on the assumption. So we can't unilaterally say the new assumption produces higher salaries or lower salaries. This is just one sample for you to look at and understand. The red line is the current assumption, what would have been used in the last valuation, and the blue line is the proposed. Now, the impact on, you know, final salary is going to vary depending on when a person came into the system, okay? Because you can kind of see that in the first 9 years or so, the proposed is actually higher than the current assumption, but it's lower after that. So for a person who hires in at an older age, there's fewer years before they reach retirement. The new assumption will actually produce a higher final average salary and a higher benefit. This particular person, for my example, is hired at age 30. And so for this person, the proposed scale produces a lower final average salary than the current scale. And I just wanted to, we were struggling with how to present that or be able to help you understand the change. And it really is very different because we're going from that select period, 5 or 10 years, and then age-based to purely service-based. But it is a little bit of both.
So this suggests that this employee would get can expect roughly about a 4% increase in pay every...
The ultimate is about 3.75.
3.7, yeah.
Okay. Yes.
And would that be every year then?
Every year.
Every year, right.
3.7,
okay.
After, and higher than that at about, as aren't too good, 13 years.
Okay.
And in this particular example, when we ran it out to see the impact, the final average salary was about 10% lower than the current assumption. But again, if we picked an age 40-year-old, the new one would produce a higher benefit. So it's a little bit of both. All right. Well, we're done with the demographic assumptions. Slide 21, we'll talk a little bit about economic assumptions. As Bill mentioned, inflation is one of the key economic assumptions, and although you don't have benefits directly related to that, it is used for both developing the salary increase assumption and the investment return. And it has to be consistent for both of those assumptions. The investment return assumption is currently 8.5%, and the recommendation in Mercer's experience study was 8%. And payroll growth... You might remember that the unfunded actuarial liability is amortized or financed as a level percent of pay. Okay, so the payroll growth assumption is how do we think covered pay is going to increase in future years? And that's going to impact the payment on the UAL. Now, in the initial Mercer report, that was 4%. Again, with our revised set of assumptions that we agreed on last week, it's 3.75. That, you know, people will come and go, but if the size of the group remains the same, we think covered payroll in aggregate will grow 3.75. Okay, so that's used to amortize the UAL. Slide 22, investment return.
If I could just back up on the payroll part, does that assume that the size of the workforce remains the same? I mean, it's possible that the workforce could get smaller, but then the raises, the pay raises might increase, and it'll average out there.
It does assume that the size of the active membership remains the same.
Right, same
thing. It neither grows nor declines.
Thanks.
So slide 22, as far as the investment return assumption, this is a very important assumption, probably the single most important assumption that's used to take all those projections of future benefit payments and translate them into a current value or a lump sum value today. Obviously, heavily dependent on the asset allocation. You're going to invest your money 80% in bonds, 20% in stocks. You're going to get a different answer than 80% in stocks, 20% fixed. And it also varies by the capital market assumptions. And I'll say more about that in a minute when you see the results of it. Certainly for methodology, the past is not necessarily an indicator of the future. And you've probably heard that lots of different times in all your mutual fund disclosures. And it's true here. It's important to look back and see what's happened. But we're driving and we're looking forward. We're not driving in our rearview mirror. And that's what Mercer's methodology and Milliman's is the same as far as kind of projecting these future returns based on the inflation assumption and the real rates of return with the different asset classes and the target asset allocation. And then under actuarial standards of practice, we actually create what's called a best estimate range and then select from within that range. But let's look on slide 22. Again, although the future is not necessarily going to be the same as the past, it is still pertinent to look at this information and provide some insight. This was the information that was readily available that was provided to us by SBI. So it's the last 16 years. You're certainly going to get a different number if more years are added in there. But for the last 16 years, the rate of return has definitely been below the 8.5% assumed. And no doubt the last decade has contributed to most of that. So I think it's just good to see that and to put things in context. But again, as we look at setting the investment return, we're trying to be prospective in nature. We're trying to look forward and see what do we think is going to happen. Again, actuaries are looking at very long term, 30 years. Investment people, long term is 10 years. So there's always a little bit of a disconnect between what we as actuaries are trying to accomplish and the information that is available from the investment side of the house. When we run the assumptions and the asset allocation through our model, it creates a range of results, and we rank those and quantify them, and it creates this best estimate range, which is between the 25th and the 75th percentile. And it tends to be, or it has in the past, that the expected return at the 50th percentile, that is generally around where the investment return assumption is set. Now, just to make sure everybody's comfortable with what these numbers mean, if we look at the first line, which were the results with SBI's target asset allocation and Milliman's capital market assumptions, when it says the 25th percentile was 6.1%, that means there was a 75% chance that the return will be 6.1% or higher. Okay? A 50% chance it'll be 7.8% or higher. And a 25% chance it's going to be 9.6% or higher. So, you know, if your assumption was 6%, you'd feel good because you've got a 75% chance of success. At around 8, you got about a 50% chance of success. That's how to sort of interpret those percentiles. Any have questions on that?
Well, of course, the 8.5% is written in statute, and I guess the easiest part of this process would be to just change the statute to say we're going to assume 8%. But if we assume 8%, doesn't that create liabilities for the funds? Because all their numbers are built around getting an 8% return. If we say now you have to assume not 8.5%, you have to assume an 8% return, all of a sudden they're going to have a bigger hole that they're going to have to fill in a shorter time to do it. Isn't that one of the downsides of us making that adjustment?
A couple of comments. You are correct. Benefits are paid from contributions or investment income, and to the extent you lower it, you say investment income is going to be 8 instead of 8.5, contributions would have to come up, and the funded status of the system would look worse. On the other hand, the returns are what they're going to be. I mean, we can use an assumption, but what plays out is what...
if we wanted to, yeah.
I mean, it's what actually happens. It's going to drive the ultimate cost. What we're trying to do is really come up with the best estimate. Mm-hmm. And you can look at the line right under Milliman's that says SBI. And that was using SBI's capital market assumptions. And you can see the results were significantly different. I mean, at the 50th percentile, their results were around 9%. And both Mercer and Milliman's were around 8%. So if you looked at that particular line, 8.5, is below the 50th percentile, so there's more than a 50% chance of success in that scenario. And that is really what's leading us to suggest that further study be done on this. It's such an important assumption, and there are differences of opinion here and different capital market assumptions, and while Both Mercer and Milliman have investment consultants within our firm. It seems like maybe a totally independent third party who doesn't have any prior knowledge or vested interest might be valuable to the commission if you're going to consider changing this. I did put some information in there on slide 25. The National Association of State Retirement Administrators maintains a survey of information from about 114 of the large systems in the United States. And I'm not necessarily saying that because everybody else is there, that's where you should be, because there are some differences here. But I think it's at least valuable to see where your peers are. So 8.5 is the highest assumption that's used, and 17 of the 114 were at 8.5%. That's about 15% of the total group. And if you look at those above 8, it's about 26%. So you are in the minority. There, again, there might be valid reasons why 8.5 is fine. But when you look at your peer group, you can see 8% is the most common. There's also been a lot of attention in the press lately about the investment return assumptions being used by pension funds. And the criticism is that they're too high. So it's a timely issue, and I think one that it probably would be prudent for you to spend some additional time on. There's also, I wouldn't call it a trend, but there's definitely, we're seeing systems lowering their investment return assumption, which that's not very common. So Colorado went from 8.5 to 8. CalSTRS, California State Teachers Retirement System, is at 8, and staff actually recommended going to 7.5. The board did not adopt that. California Public Employees Retirement Systems, which is a major leader in the public retirement community, they are currently at 7.75, and they will be evaluating that and making a decision at the end of this year. And New Jersey's at 8.25, and they're pretty seriously considering dropping down to 7.5. So just to be aware that there's a lot of activity in this area right now, a lot of focus. It isn't necessarily something, you know, that you have to do right now, but we also don't necessarily think it should just wait till the next experience study, that it might be, you know, when you have some time, it's in statute, it has to be, you know, nothing can be done till the next legislative session anyway. That it's a very important assumption, and we think that it's worth your time and effort to really dig into that, and that you probably need an investment expert who can really visit with SBI about their investment strategy and, you know, where their capital market assumptions are coming from, and provide a level of expertise that we as actuaries can't provide.
Well, Ms. Beckham, you indicated we should study this. Obviously, no one knows what the future rate of return is going to be, so we can't study that. We can look backward and figure out, okay, what were the benchmarks that made. Now, that may guide us or not. I suspect that some of the other states have probably dropped it because they've had a couple of years where they didn't meet, you know, their goal, and they figured, well, we better make adjustments accordingly or this hole is going to get deeper and deeper. But I'm not quite sure what else we can study other than look backwards and say, you know, how close to the mark did we come? Is that...
I think if... Here's our perspective. When we use SBI's capital market assumptions, we're getting a very different range of results. I mean, 1% is a huge difference. And if it's under that set of assumptions, you could easily argue 8.5 is fine. But for both Mercer and Milliman's capital market assumptions, they would make it look like 8.5 is kind of on the high side. So that's why we think it would be beneficial to have somebody who is an investment expert come and weigh. I mean, I think you're getting two different answers. Mm-hmm. And if I were you, I would like somebody to help me decide which one of those two answers is perhaps the more valid or explain the differences. And maybe there's somebody, you know, at SBI that can do that. I think that's the issue for us is, you know, if they'd all synced up, there wouldn't be any discussion. But we have some pretty different results on a critical assumption, and that's where I think, again, it has to be forward-looking. And we are hearing a lot of investment consultants who, at least for the next 10 to 15 years, don't seem to be particularly optimistic. That's not my area of expertise. I'm just telling you what I hear at other board meetings. And there certainly are a number of systems that are reevaluating, and I think that's all prospective in nature, regardless of where we've been. Because most of these funds have made their 8% return in the last 20 to 30 years. Their concern is the next 30.
Sir Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if it's on the agenda today, but it sounds like it might be helpful for us, if not today, at some point, to hear some further comments from SBI on their thoughts related to this assumption. And I'm wondering if Mr. Martin or Mr. Burke could comment on how long have we been at 8.5?
Members, my memory is it was 1987 or 1989 that we went to 8.5%. 89, I'm told.
And we're going to have response from the major funds after this. SBI wasn't on the agenda, but I don't know if anybody's heard from there. But
Mr. Baker's.
Yeah, they're here.
Oh, okay, he's here, so we can respond to that. But we'll be hearing from responses after the presentation by them. Sarah Rosa?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mrs. Beckham, maybe this is proprietary information and you can't share, but does Milliman also have the Colorado and the California funds? Are they under somebody else?
Are we the retained actuary for mm-hmm. those funds? We are not the retained actuary for Colorado Para. Mm-hmm. We are for California State Teachers Retirement System.
Thank you.
Okay. Oh, Mr. Martin.
Ms. Beckham, I have one question about the investment return actuarial assumptions. Something I didn't notice in the Mercer report or your review, we have a post-retirement investment return assumption and a pre-retirement investment return assumption, in part because we account for our post-retirement increases by reducing the amount of the post-retirement investment return. And I didn't see any recommendation about whether that practice should be retained. Should we be using a single investment actuarial assumption or continuing our current system of not directly having an assumption as to post-retirement increases, but doing it by a backdoor way in that we reduce the interest assumption for post-retirement lives? Did I miss something in those two reports?
No,
was that something
I
that did not come up?
I don't believe I saw it in Mercer's, and I know we didn't comment on it. That is a very common approach to reflect the impact of a COLA. Of a compound COLA is to basically reduce your investment return assumption by that percentage. And I think that's probably why we didn't specifically comment on it. It's very common, and it's equivalent to saying it's 8.5, but you've got a 2.5% cost of living adjustment. I think the current methodology, or current approach, is fine. I don't have a concern.
Okay, proceed.
Well, I think we'll wrap it up. On slide 28, just some concluding comments. All the work that actuaries do are governed by the standards of practice that are published by the American Academy of Actuaries. And, of course, here in Minnesota, the commission standards for actuarial work as well. The experience studies that we reviewed complied with all of those requirements. Again, the recommended changes were reasonable, they're appropriate, supported by the experience. And the ultimate set of assumptions that are being proposed, in our opinion, are reasonable. There may be some implications for the funds as far as administrative issues like early retirement factors or optional form factors that might be required to be changed as a result of the mortality and or investment return assumption change. And I know they're aware of that. The follow-up items for the commission, again, the combined service annuity, it would be, I think, prudent for that to be studied sometime in the next year or so. And then I know there'll be more discussion on the investment return assumption, and we believe that that discussion needs to occur so you can make a decision on what's appropriate. That concludes our comments on the experience study.
Any questions from the members on that? We're going to be hearing momentarily from the funds, their reactions. Let me just back up one step here. We've got we do have a quorum present, and so Representative Murphy moves approval of the commission minutes of March. What's the date here? March 5, 2010. Discussion on the motion. Hearing none, all in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the motion prevails. Okay, can we get some responses from MSRS, PERA, TRA, and if the State Board of Investment wants to weigh in, we'd appreciate that too. So please come to the witness table and identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, my name is Dave Bergstrom, the director of the Minnesota State Retirement System. I do appreciate the work that both Mercer and Milliman did. As Ms. Beckham said, that actuaries sometimes have different views, different ideas. We did work with Mercer and Milliman and the funds to come up with some assumption changes. And one of the things we would like to do is get those adopted so that we can use them in this next valuation to have the most reasonable actuarial valuation that we can have done. So I don't know if you wish to take those up.
We've got some motion documents in your packets, members. Some would be things that the commission can approve, and some would require statutory changes, which, of course, we cannot approve at this time, but we'd be giving direction to the various funds. Are we prepared to talk about these yet?
Mr. Chair, we could talk about them, but their reaction would...
Okay. Why don't you give us your reaction first, and then we'll talk about the things that you are looking to us to adopt. Do you agree or disagree with what you heard from Milliman, and then we can talk about... you know, any changes that are within our purview to make, if so.
Mr. Chair, we agree in most instances of what Milliman said, especially regarding the assumption changes that would be appropriate. For example, the number of retirements, we're looking at change there. We've recognized for a long time that fewer people are retiring under the rule of 90. We don't think it's a short-term trend. We've noticed it for a long time. People cannot afford the insurance cost to retire before age 65. Under the state, you're looking at probably $1,300, $1,400 a month for insurance. And we've seen a definite trend. We think some of that will continue. So we are in agreement with what they say. The investment return, Mr. Bicker could address. So from MSRS's standpoint, we think the analysis is good, and the thought of reaching kind of a more conservative set of assumptions we're very comfortable with as well. So we're comfortable.
Are there other reasons why people are continuing working longer when they could retire beyond that insurance or health care?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think recently people's deferred comp accounts are down, their savings accounts are down. Okay. So that is making people work longer. And I think some people expecting retire and go to work afterwards, well, the jobs aren't there, so I think that really even increased it. I would expect if we took the two-year experience after the 4 years that we were just looked at, we'd expect even fewer retirements, I think. We've seen a drop in the number of retirements, and I think that's driven more by just the current market. You know, people are afraid. They got a job, they're going to hold on to it. So, I think... generally, health insurance is the long-term driver, but I think economic problems have even increased the resistance of people to sort of move on to retirement.
Okay, any questions, Mr. Bergstrom? Vanek?
Mr. Chair and members, Mary Vanek, Director of PERA.
We approached the assumption change recommendations a little differently, in as we asked that the economic assumption changes be put into statute. So you incorporated that into the legislation passed this year. In having a follow-up conversation with Milliman after passage of the bill, they are recommending a little bit more conservative approach. So in statute, through passage of the bill, we are already, we have moved to a 4% payroll growth assumption and a salary scale that tops out at 3.5%. What is being recommended today is that beginning next year, July 1, 2011 valuation, we modify the payroll growth from 4 to 3.75%. The actuaries agreed that we should be a little bit more moderate in that, and that we change our salary growth assumption to align with that. So instead of having a maximum increase in salaries for our members at 3.5%, we would move to 3.75%. Because the statute is already very plain that it's 4% and 3.5% this year, we can't make that change until 2011, but we would hope that you would adopt the changes as recommended by the actuaries effective for July 2011's valuation, and we agree with that. While the board did approve what we put into statute at last month's board meeting, they did give me the authority to work with the actuaries and make the modifications that they deemed reasonable. With respect to our demographic assumptions, first of all, Senator Betzel, to reflect on your comment on our termination assumptions, mm-hmm. It was over a decade ago
right. That
it was discovered that we were assuming more people were leaving the system who weren't eligible for a benefit than was actually occurring, and that added a significant cost to our plan. What this experience is showing is that has reversed course somewhat, and while it has reversed course, the actuaries are not comfortable that they've gotten the correct data set yet to make a modification this year, and so we agreed to let's wait and collect more data and look at it more carefully. With respect to mortality, there was a recommendation that the generational table is appropriate, but it isn't an exact fit as recommended. We asked that be accepted and reviewed more closely next experience study because, contrary to my peer systems, that's a 1% cost, 1% of pay in terms of contribution cost to us, and we did factor that into everything we presented to you this year with respect to the financial sustainability provisions. So that's why we asked that they move forward with accepting that. Retirement rates, we, like MSRS, are seeing fewer retirements, but again, Milliman was not comfortable that it was necessarily the best fit as we were going forward. So that assumption in discussions between the two actuaries was somewhat modified, and we support that. So the motion before you on those demographic assumptions that would apply this year, we support. And the economic assumption, while I see staff would like a supplemental valuation to look at the difference, we'd like to see that supported for next year's valuation. We agree with what has been said about the investment return. The PERA board, in fact, has asked that we look very carefully and work with the commission on how we can bring that down to a more a level that people are more comfortable with. Their concern is 2 years ago when we analyzed moving that from 8.5 to 8, it added 2.2% of pay increase in contributions, and we have to figure out a way to mitigate that impact. But what we also understand that it is something we need to continue to look at. This is the third, I think, experience study where it's been discussed is let's look at it.
But if next year's legislature decides to move the assumed rate from 8.5 down to 8, that is going to create a hole for you and the other funds. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair, we're going to have to figure out how we're going to deal with that contribution impact.
Okay. Any questions? PER. Ms. Vanek, did you want to weigh in on TRA before we...
Okay.
Ms. Hacking, TRA, before we go to Mr. Bicker.
Laurie Hacking with TRA. Pretty much ditto. We agree with Milliman's recommendations and appreciate that they're taking a somewhat more conservative approach, which we think makes sense given our current funding situation. So we're comfortable with the recommendations. With respect to the investment assumption change, we do think you need to take some time and careful consideration before changing it. And Mr. Bicker, I'm sure, will speak to that in a minute. With respect to TRA, the change from 8.5 to 8 would add about 2.7 to 3% of pay to our required contribution rate. So it's a very significant impact. And, again, we just hope you'll take your time and deliberate what the appropriate approach might be.
Would that increase? I mean, we just increased the employer and employee contribution rates in this last year's bill, so this is on top of what we've already done if we were to go to 8%.
Mr. Chair, yes, that's correct. The package that was approved would help TRA to the degree of about 7% of payroll, all the combination of changes, benefit reductions and contribution changes, and it left us still with a somewhat of a deficiency of about 3 to 4%. So this change in the actuarial assumption for investments would add another 3% roughly to those costs. So instead of having a deficiency of 3 to 4%, we'd be having a deficiency of 7 to 8%.
Okay. Any questions? Mr. Bicker, what does it look like down the road?
You can carry that.
Mr. Chairman and members, if I knew, I wouldn't be here. But, you know, the reality is I should argue for the 8 would make my life easier. The reality is, I've had a number of these debates with Mercer at the various board meetings over the last months. The only thing we know for sure is whether it's 8.5 or 8, they're both wrong. You know, we talk about investing over long periods of time. The State Board, over the last 30 years, has compounded at 9.7%. Last year, we made, and these are preliminary numbers, 15.2. Now, you know, we've had some pretty bad years. The markets are going to go up. The markets are going to go down. You know, there's been some discussions about our economic assumptions. Our economic assumptions didn't come from the State Board. I mean, we surveyed Wall Street. We surveyed a number of consulting organizations that we have access to. We didn't pull those numbers out of the sky. And I am not assuming that anybody or inferring that anybody said we pulled those out of the sky, but we use a lot of resources that we have at our disposal to come up with our assumptions. What I've found interesting, Mr. Chairman and members, over the years is if you sit back and maybe unfortunately I've been around for all of these, you go back to the 70s and the world was ending. You go back to 1987 during the World Series, we had a little market crash and the world was ending. We go to 2001 and 2002 with the dot-com bubble and the terrorist attacks, the world was ending. We go to 2008, the world was ending. Every time you talk to Wall Street and to those who are projecting, they seem to look at what's happening right now and not really what's happened over 30 years, at least in my opinion. You know, and if you went to some of these same people in 1995, you know, stocks are going to return 20% a year and don't worry about a thing and everything is fine. So it's human nature that we all tend to react to where we are now. And the last couple of years, I mean, this most recent year wasn't bad, but the previous 2 years were anything but fun. I personally believe that if you have a relatively well-constructed long-term portfolio with a pretty significant equity exposure, that the return assumptions will be attainable, but there's going to be volatility. I mean, I really think what we need to do, and again, I don't mean to get off on a tangent, but if we ever get into surpluses again, we can't give them away in benefits. We got to keep them. If anything we've learned is we got to be careful about how the benefit side of this equation. If you really look at it, the investment side of the equation for since 1-1 of 80 has returned 9.7. If there was sufficient money going in and no benefits granted, we'd be fine. We would not have this conversation. So, do I think the state board and the investment markets will provide 8.5%? I hope so. I think so. And the difference between 8.5 and 8, when you really look at it, all we know is they're both going to be wrong. So, Mr. Chairman and members, if there's any questions, I'd gladly try to respond.
Any questions? Okay. Is there anybody else who's here who wants to be heard on the review of the experience study reports? We do have a couple of things here, but when is the next experience study report? When are they actually due next from the funds?
4 years after 2008.
4 years after 2008, so they're next due in
2012.
Okay. Well, and...
done in 2013.
Okay, so, and we certainly hope that they'll be submitted in a timely manner, right?
Mr. Chair, they will.
Absolutely.
Okay. We have a couple of motions in your packet, members, and they're on legal-sized paper, and it's 07-08-10-1-7, I guess it is. Okay. The first one, and Mr. Martin, is this is for MSRS, and this is something the commission can approve, and can we have a discussion of what this is, and Mr. Bergstrom, why should we do this? Okay. Mr. Martin.
Members, what we've done is broken the various motions to approve or come as close to approval as we can by fund, and so you've got six motions that are reflective of what the funds have indicated they've agreed to and what Milliman has told us is the recent consensus as to the actuarial assumption changes. In the event that you want to go beyond that and want to do the entirety of the Mercer package, not as analyzed by Milliman, I do have motions that would do that. Mr. Bergstrom suggested we ought to have them here today, and we do. So if you want to do something different than what Milliman has covered in its review and what the funds have just testified that they generally want to do, then we would have to do something different than these set of motions. But this reflects the most recent agreement. 1 and 2, dash 1 and dash 2, reflect MSRS. We can approve demographic changes under the current version of Section 356.215. So motion one changes the mortality rate assumptions, the retirement rate assumption, the marital status, age of beneficiary, and annuity form actuarial assumptions. That's the first page. What's attached is the recent letter from Mercer reflecting the agreement as to MSRS's assumptions. And that's what this motion largely would implement. Dash 2 gets into the economic assumptions where, since they're still statutory through the 2010 valuation, can't be changed by the commission, but the commission can get as close to approving them by requesting that the alternative actuarial assumptions be costed out in the next set of valuations as a supplemental item. So one is the actual assumptions that can be approved by the pension commission.
Okay.
For MSRS.
Okay, let's look at number one first. This is MSRS, and Mr. Bergstrom, did you have any comment on these actuarial assumption changes? And these are consistent with what Milliman and Mercer are recommending to MSRS?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. These are the more conservative assumptions that we worked with Milliman and Mercer that both felt were reasonable.
Okay.
And we are supportive as well.
Okay. Discussion, is there a motion to adopt number one for MSRS?
So moved.
Okay. Representative Nelson moves a motion 07-08-10-1. These these would adopt these actuarial assumption changes for MSRS. Discussion on that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. And number dash two is, again, in statute, but it's a payroll growth. So we would be asking them to incorporate them, but we can't direct them because it'd have to require a statute. Mr. Bergstrom?
Mr. Chair, if I understand what the motion does is that it would have us do the actuarial evaluation under the current assumptions, and we would show this as a supplemental report as well. And we're comfortable with that. The only thing that I would request would be that if the motion then said we could use these for the official evaluation on the 2011 report, then we would not have to, you would not have to revisit it, and we would then eliminate the double calculation. So the next report would show both, and then hopefully we could adopt these for the 2011.
Unfortunately, what the statute says is what we all have to do. So I don't know that this commission can make a motion to change a statute. So
I had a brief discussion with Martin, and I thought we could after 2010.
Mr. Martin, what's the effect of this?
Members, I only went as far as to get the situations corrected for the 2010 valuations. Mr. Bergstrom is talking about the 2011 and thereafter valuations. For the 2011 valuations under Minnesota Statute Section 356.215, the salary and payroll growth actuarial assumptions will shift from being statutory assumptions to being assumptions that the Pension Commission sets by approval. So what he's asking for is to approve as of a year hence the actual assumptions that Milliman and Mercer have developed. So it would be for 2010, it would be done on a demonstration basis, and then to give it a permanent implementation for the following year.
So
that would be language more akin to the language that you saw in the front end of the dash one amendment, talking about approval for valuations, and would be beginning July 1, 2011 instead of 2010. It's not a step that you need to take. He's suggesting that because you're fully informed at this moment, it makes some sense to deal with it, but it legally is not absolutely necessary to do it now.
Well, I mean, hypothetically, the statute could be changed next year to extend the time period, so what I think would be prudent, if it's the commission's will, we could adopt this payroll growth assumption as its recommendation, and then once the statute does go into effect that it's within the purview of this commission, the commission can always vote again when it really is in our jurisdiction. Right now it's not. But I think once the statute goes into effect, we could, probably the commission can do it again. So, Sarah Rosa, could you hold it, Santa Thor, just a second. Representative Murphy moves the dash two. Is there discussion of that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. Oops.
I don't know how we do two reports for 1 year, but
motion fails.
Members,
fails, right?
Members, if I could at this point, this the commission rule that requires three members from each body approving something applies to legislative recommendations.
Okay.
This is an administrative item, so a majority of a quorum would be sufficient.
But we have, six members? So five. We'd still need six votes, right?
Majority of a quorum.
Majority of a quorum.
A majority of a quorum. Oh, I see. Okay. Okay. So okay, the motion does prevail.
5-0-6.
Okay. You can go.
Okay.
Okay. Can you hold off for a minute or two?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Thanks.
Maybe.
Okay.
Now that she's sitting down.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. 03 is PERA, and there is something we can approve. And okay, let's look. Next one's Murph. PERA, Mr. Murph.
Members, the dash three relates to PERA. It's identical in effect to the dash one motion that we just adopted for MSRS. It approves those actuarial assumptions related to PERA general that can be approved at this time by the pension commission.
And these are consistent with the Milliman and Mercer recommendation. Ms. Vanek?
Mr. Chair, we support this.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I move adoption.
Okay. Representative Murphy moves adoption of dash 3 for PERA. Discussion of the motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Fails. Number 4 is Murph. Mr. Martin.
Members, if you take the dash 4 document and turn to the second full page, the second, I guess it would be the third page of the document, just flip the cover page over. This is the portion of the 2010 omnibus pension bill that, if you look on section 23 in the middle of the page, it requires input from the MRF actuary with respect to the actuarial assumptions to be used by PERA in the first actuarial valuation of the MRF division that will occur for the 2010 valuations. And on that basis, the successive pages after the copy of the 2010 omnibus bill, you'll find the letter that we received from Gabriel Roeder Smith, the actuary retained for MRF, and the dash 4 motion implements that recommendation.
Ms. Vandick, you've got MRF now. What's any comment on that?
Mr. Chair, these are the assumptions we discussed throughout the legislative process, so we support this.
Murphy moves the dash 4 document. Discussion of that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails. Dash 5 is PERA, and this is the payroll growth assumption, similar to the one we looked at MSRS. Mr. Martin?
Members, this was something that Ms. Vanek just referenced in her comments that she would, as I understand her comments, prefer not to do dash 5. This implements or requests PERA to do the for the 2010 valuation as a supplemental item. The calculations under the payroll and salary scale actuarial assumptions that were reached by consensus between the funds, Milliman and Mercer. And if I understand Ms. Vanek's testimony, she would prefer to not do that in 2010. But wait until the 2011 actuarial evaluation.
Yeah, I'm trying. Ms. Vanek, you said you were going to revisit the issue or something. Ms. Vanek, did you need all 5 or?
Mr. Chair, I didn't mean to imply I didn't think that's what I said. Statutorily, we made the change to 4 and 3.5, so that's in place for 2010. And we can certainly do the supplemental to review what was agreed upon between the two actuaries after the legislation passed that changed our assumptions and statutes. So this could then be considered as the change in 2011, just as you discussed with Mr. Bergstrom. So we changed our assumptions and statute this year to align with what Mercer recommended. Milliman recommended something a little more conservative. That's what you see here. So the supplemental valuation will then show the commission whether or not we should stay with what we recommended last year in this year's bill or move to this approach. So I don't oppose this.
But you're still going to proceed with the statute, obviously, and this is just some additional.
So just so I'm clear on this, Mr. Chair, so it's only in statute for 1 year, and then in 2011 this is again comes back to the commission to make the recommendation about? So we sunsetted the statutory provision?
Mr. Martin?
Members, in 2008 or 2009, the pension funds asked that the salary scale and payroll growth assumptions be made subject to legislative commission approval and not set in statute. And that was set for valuations after 2010. As part of the 2010 omnibus pension bill, PERA requested and the legislature approved a change in their payroll and salary scale assumptions, and that's attached to motion dash 5, that portion of the 2010 omnibus bill.
And Mr. Chair,
so for PERA only, it has the impact of a 1 year and then no longer applicable. For everyone else, they've had salary scale assumptions since Chapter 356 was put in statute in 1965.
President Chase.
And Mr. Chair, I'm still not clear why we're doing 1 year of supplemental and using the resources to do that when we're going to be changing it a year from now.
Members, we're not doing any extra work. What will happen is there are some extra pages that will be added to the next evaluation. The actuaries, in order to gauge what the impact on the liability and unfunded liability, have to cost out or have to run evaluation essentially on the old assumptions and the new assumptions to identify what gain or loss is attributable to assumption changes. That's part of the normal actuarial work whenever their actuarial assumption changes. So they would, if we were going to put this new set of assumptions into play, they've got to gauge them with the new assumptions, the old assumptions anyway. So this is just having them, rather than wait a year and then do it, and we're getting a look at what the actual impact of the agreed upon set of assumptions will be all together at the earliest possible date.
But to your earlier point, we don't know if we're going to make those changes, or we should just put them all in place now and
I'm going to assume that there's not going to be a change in the statute, you know, next year, and I'm assuming that the Legislative Commission is going to then have the authority to make the changes. We can't do it now, but as long as we're going that direction, I think that, you know, as long as the funds are okay with making that, taking a look at the change in payroll growth as part of their evaluations, you know, we might as well get that information as well, too. Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Motion 5, then, does that, that's just having to do with PERA?
Correct.
Not the Lute teachers, St. Paul teachers, and all that stuff that's in the other language?
The next two motions deal with TRA. And I don't know if it deals with Duluth teachers or not. No, but this is only PERA.
Okay.
So okay, Representative Murphy moves the 5 motion. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Okay. And then number 6 is TRA. Mr. Martin?
Members, number 6 is following the same pattern. The items that can be given final approval by the Pension Commission as recommended by Mercer and Milliman after the review is set forth in 6. The document from Mercer specifying what items were to be changed is part of your, or is attached to your 06 motion, and that's what the 06 motion attempts to do, is to implement that.
And this is only TRA, doesn't deal with Duluth teachers or St. Paul teachers?
Members, this is only TRA, just as the MSRS was only the general state employees plan and PERA was only the PERA general plan.
Ms. Hocking?
We're comfortable with the amendment.
Motion to adopt 6?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy moves adoption of 6. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. And then 7 is TRA payroll growth.
Members, this again is a request, because this is an item that is not subject to our commission approval, final approval at this time. So it's the payroll growth and salary scale for TRA.
Second?
We're fine.
Okay. Discussion on that motion. Is it moved?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy moves number 7. All those in favor, please. Discussion. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Okay. Mr. Martin?
One other item, if I could. Members, as I think Milliman observed, these assumption changes only apply to 3 pension plans out of the 12 or so that we have run by these folks and the other major plans. Doesn't apply to PERA, Police and Fire, the State Patrol Plan, MSRS Correctional, the PERA Local Government Correctional Plan. I would like to ask the pension fund administrators what they intend to do with respect to formulating actuarial assumptions and actual assumption changes with respect to those plans. So that's on the record. And if we've seen salary growth assumption changes and turnover and whatever, is there any reason to believe that we need to address immortality more pertinent? Is there a need to address those other plans? And what plans do they have to assemble that set of assumptions, because they will come back to the commission if they do assemble some additional assumptions.
Mr. Burstrom, Ms. Vanek?
Mr. Chair, I will address that first. We did consult with you earlier that we thought there was a need to do an experience study of the police and fire plan. That study has been undertaken, and recommendations for assumption changes will be reported to the PERA Board of Trustees at our August board meeting, and the cost implications associated with that. We don't know if that will be timely enough for the commission to act on those demographic assumption changes for this valuation. We assumed it probably would carry to next year's valuation if you because the actuarial work begins soon. We did find that there were more retirements at age 50 than we were assuming. There are fewer disabilities, far fewer disabilities, as a result of the changes that you've enacted over the last several years. Salary overall, there's some modifications, but we asked the actuary to take a little bit more specific look at some of the employers within the system, because we do know that there have been there's been lots of overtime in some communities, and we wanted to make sure that we were acknowledging what was really going on within areas of the plan, not just as an aggregate. And of course, mortality is always an issue, and I'm sure there are going to be assumption recommendations to improve our life expectancies in that plan, but I do not have those for you at this time. The local government correctional we haven't looked at, but it is certainly something that we're going to want the actuary to do a review on, not necessarily a full-blown experience analysis, but some level of review, especially with respect to mortality.
Mr. Bergstrom?
Chair, Nate Bergstrom, the director of the state retirement system. We may not do an experience study. We recently changed the assumptions. I believe it was 3 years ago. But I think we will look at adopting some of the mortality changes and some of the other changes that are similar. But I doubt we would do a full-blown experience study at this point.
Okay, any questions or discussion? Okay. Why don't we, well, that finishes that point. Let's take about a 10-minute break, and then we'll pick up with the remaining items. I think we could still be out here by about 2 o'clock or so, but I think the next items won't take that long. So, okay, let's take a 10-minute recess.
3 should not take long. I don't know about 4.
Are the Millman folks still? Yeah, okay, we're going? Okay. Okay, well, go back on the record, resume the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement. The next item that we've got on our agenda are standards for actuarial work. This is actually a direction as to what the actuaries are supposed to be doing, and this is a presentation by Millman. If you look through the standards, there's a lot of changes that need to be made. I mean, we refer to the Minneapolis Teachers Pension Fund, which doesn't exist, refers to MRF as a separate fund and so forth. So there's some changes that have to be made. Milliman, yeah, would you come on back to the witness table and basically kind of review what is in here? It looks to be more technical things, but you'll have to describe it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the Commission. Again, there should be a hard copy of a PowerPoint presentation that we'll use to walk through the changes to the proposed changes to the standards. You all have a copy of that?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Just to kind of refresh everyone's memory, on slide 3, the purpose of the standards are really to provide guidance and make sure that sound actuarial principles are followed in all aspects of the actuarial work, the assumptions, evaluations, experience studies, cost studies. A second bullet there, probably very important to you as members of the commission, to provide some uniformity in the approaches and the actuarial processes to be sure that there's financial comparability of different retirement plans. And then the last is to really assist you in your development of public policy decisions regarding public pension plans. On slide 4, as far as the scope of the review, there certainly were a number of changes that needed to be made to be consistent with changes in the law. That did include, MRF moving to PARA. There were some changes that were required because the commission's actuary no longer does the formal valuation and experience studies. They're in a reviewing role. So there was a lot of what I would term cleanup. And then there were some specific areas that were impacted, and we'd like to spend most of our time talking about those, which are on the next several slides. On slide five, as far as the changes to the standards with respect to actuarial valuations, the first bullet there, we think that there's a value in providing key actuarial results using both actuarial and market value. And I would comment that most, if not all, of the firms did provide that information in the 2009 valuation reports, and it was very helpful. When the actuarial value is significantly different than market value, it's very helpful to have that information. This just puts that requirement in the standards that it would be reported in every valuation report on both bases. We're talking basically, you know, the unfunded actuarial liability, the funded ratio, and the actuarial contribution rate are the key results that need to be reported on both bases. The second expands the reporting for actuarial gains and losses by source. In the actuarial process, we do a calculation that compares the expected unfunded liability to the actual unfunded liability. And that difference is either a gain or a loss in aggregate, and then we like to be able to break that down and look at the components. That gives us some insight into how the actuarial assumptions are anticipating experience. And there are several sources that are already included in the standards. This would add the retirement assumption and termination of employment assumptions as a specific calculation of gain or loss. And then there is a requirement right now that if the other category, which is kind of the catch-all category, is more than a certain dollar amount or percentage, it requires additional analysis, and we're just recommending that the dollar amount of impact go away and that other category be evaluated in terms of the overall actuarial liability. So if it's more than a half percent of the actuarial liability, then the actuary needs to dig into that and find out why and report that. The actuarial standards already require that decrement timing, change of status, in general, is mid-year. And we just thought that should be clarified. That came out when we did the audit last year, that Mercer was using July 1, and so we wanted to clarify that mid-year decrement timing is actually 6 months after the valuation date, which would be January 1 for these plans, middle of the plan year. We thought that right now the standard is pretty firm on that's what has to be used. There certainly are situations where that might not be reasonable or could even be done, and so we would recommend that you maybe keep that mid-year timing as a preferred approach, but that the commission would have the authority to make exceptions to that rule if somebody came to you and made the case. The last bullet there, I think, is a reflection of you know, some of what we've been living with the last few years. The valuation is very useful and helpful information, but even to us as actuaries, it doesn't provide any insight into a longer-term horizon as far as the financial health of the plan or the retirement system. A valuation model basically is showing you the valuation results in each future year under a certain set of assumptions. An investment return is the big assumption. We talked about that a lot this morning. And so that allows you to do some sensitivity analysis. Let's say, you know, we don't make 8.5 for the next 10 years. Say it's 7.5, and then it's better after that. And you can do some analysis and see what the impact of that is. And it really provides a lot of insight. And I think you as commission members need to have that kind of insight and be able to see what variability does to the funding of these plans and what the implications are.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Beckman, is this valuation model, is this something fairly new that is being recommended, or has this been in the works for a while?
Beckman?
to respond to that, I guess, as far as Milliman's practice, we've been using valuation models for a long time. I can remember when we started working with the state of Kansas in 1994, we did a model for them. And we've really come to the position where we almost won't do a valuation without a model, because it's so important to help not just our clients, but to help us understand what the dynamics are and what the impacts are longer term than just that 1 year. And so we think, you know, if we look at sort of best practices, you know, most valuable information, we think this is an important addition. It clearly comes with a cost. There will be a cost, I'm sure, to prepare that. But I think when you look at the size of the fund versus the cost of that model, it's pretty small. I think it provides a lot of insight for you when you're, you know, making evaluations on the health of these plans.
And Mr. Chair?
Senator Rosen.
The same thing applies to Ms. Beckman, the investment requirement or criteria, what did you call it? Recommendation, the investment recommendation. Is that something that's fairly new also?
Ms. Beckham?
You're asking us to do an investment, what's it called?
From the last presentation,
mm-hmm.
Senator?
Yeah.
Oh, I think at the last presentation, our recommendation was that you study the investment return assumption further and perhaps solicit some specific expertise from investment experts,
and
would be separate. I think that's separate from this. I want to make sure I'm
right. I know.
Communicating. Okay.
Right. And Mr. Chair, Ms. Beckman, and that is something that's fairly new, or something that's new lately too, because of the volatility of the markets and the way these.
Actually, the investment return assumptions evaluated every time there's an experience study,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes probably even when it's not. It's the challenge is the prospective nature of investment returns and what those will be over the next 20 to 30 years. I think what we're recommending is further study, given the fact that there are some very different results based on Mercer, Milliman, and when I say SBI assumptions, that just means those are the ones they sent me. I know I heard Mr. Bicker say that they had some assistance developing those. So that process is included in every experience analysis because that is such an important assumption. I think you're just at a position now where because there's some pretty different results coming from different advisors, you may want to be sure that you're comfortable with the 8.5, and that may take further study.
So, Mr. Chair, so
Ms. Beckham,
so the evaluation model is extra money, and the investment experts are that is already included in the. I'm just trying to figure out how much more we have to spend here to get down.
I may not be the right person to answer that, but I assume if you hire an investment expert, they won't work for free.
Okay, so these are two separate added costs onto the.
Right. Okay. Right. And in the valuation models, it probably makes sense for the retained actuary to provide those models because they're doing the valuations.
Okay, go ahead.
All right, slide 6 on the experience study. this really just adds some language that provides that the investment return assumption, the development and the experience study will be prospective in nature. Right now there's language that talks about calculating the rate of return in the past, but as we talked about earlier in the prior presentation, the focus for investment return is future looking. And so this is just a little bit of cleanup to clarify that. It also, the language that we added in the standards clarifies that the actuary can use professional judgment as well as the actual experience. Right now, the standards speak pretty strongly to following the actual experience. And you heard this morning that several times we felt it would be more conservative not to follow actual experience, not to go all the way anyway. And so this just provides that in the standards and clarifies that that's acceptable to use professional judgment. The standards do provide that a lot of numerical information be included in the experience study, which is very helpful. But it's also sometimes difficult to look at tables of numbers and really evaluate it, even for actuaries. And so our recommendation on that is to present those results graphically as well as in, you know, tables of numbers. I think that will make it easier for you to understand them and make it very easy to compare the current versus the proposed change. I heard Ms. Vanek say that they were doing an experience study for para, police, and fire, and we think that's a good idea. We'd like to see a formal experience study for para, police, and fire, and maybe even para correctional and MSRS correctional groups. Think that they're big enough to get some value out of doing an experience study. And then kind of hand in hand with that, for the smaller funds that aren't large enough to really do a formal experience study, we'd like the standards to reflect that after the experience studies are published for the three big funds, that the smaller funds formally review their assumptions and that the actuary for those systems makes a recommendation to either keep the assumption or change them. This just makes sure that all of the funds are taking a close look at their actuarial assumptions on a regular basis, and none of them slip through the cracks. And then the last bullet there, it goes back to some of the questions this morning. When there is a recommended change in the assumptions, it's very helpful to be able to see the cost impact of that change. It helps the reader understand how significant that change is. This requirement would say that the cost impact, and that would be both on the unfunded actuarial liability and the contribution rate, be included in the experience study report. In our experience, normally that work is done. It just isn't in the report right now. On slide 7, for cost estimates that are provided for fiscal notes, we'd like to see some expansion of the information that's included in that in the standards as far as the information. And then the second bullet there is sort of a recognition that, you know, anytime there's a benefit improvement and you're increasing benefits, you're really increasing risk for the system because you're promising future benefits. And we think it might be helpful and insightful to be able to have an alternative cost analysis where at least the assumed rate of return is, you know, lower than the valuation assumption. So when you're looking at it, okay, you know, it costs, you know, 0.5% of pay. If you make your 8.5, what if you don't? I mean, what if it's 7? That 0.5% is 2%. I mean, it's, again, to provide more information to you as decision makers in evaluating any kind of benefit improvement. Slide 8, these
we
are
might
just
never do anything.
These are just the cleanup items that we basically were able to delete some sections that no longer applied and hopefully pared down the pages of the standards. And then the third bullet, we've had a lot of discussion about the investment return assumption. It's in statute now. It at least seems like an outsider and a fresh pair of eyes worth asking the question, why isn't that assumption, you know, within the purview of the commission to approve a change, and it would be handled the same as other assumptions? So I think it might be at least worth having you guys think about taking it specifically out of statute, and, you know, this group would approve any change in the investment return assumption, and it gets a little bit away from it has to be done in a certain time period each year. So in conclusion, I think most of these recommendations are, you know, best practices, perfect world, whatever you want to call them. There may be reasons why it's not possible or not feasible, and we certainly have an open mind to that. And that is exactly why for certain items we tried to give the commission authority to accept a different approach. Our goal was really to improve the standards, you know, where we saw that possible, generally expanding some of the information that's provided, and, you know, to add some clarity on certain issues where there could be a different interpretation, like the mid-year timing. We talked about the cleanup, the change for MRF, the fact that the commission's actuary is reviewing the work rather than performing it. Please know we didn't make any changes to specifically make anybody's life more complicated, even though it may result in that. We were really hoping to provide some added value from the additional work. And then last, I think, and Bill's a little more familiar with the standards than I am, but as a new kid on the block, I recognize that the fund administrators and the various retained actuaries have been living with these standards longer than I have, and I value their input, and I think it would be a good idea for the commission to solicit their input before any changes are finalized, and I'm assuming there will be some input today. That concludes our remarks.
Thank you. And we've got a document in our packet that shows the page and line numbers. One question I've got, I mean, the last couple of sections, there's appendices, and it has blank pages in there. Is this, there will be documents that would go as part of this, like Appendix G, plan-specific actuarial valuation assumptions? I mean, we have a blank page here, but I'm assuming that there's something that would go in here.
Yes, and I think those would not be changed from what is there now, Senator.
Okay. Any questions? Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Beckman, first just a comment on page 6, your last bullet, where you talk about providing the cost impact of each change in assumption. I think that's a real positive thing, and I think it's reflective of comments that Representative Thiessen made here even earlier today. Mr. Chair, I'm wondering, it's often that we see suggested changes or recommendations that come to the commission from Mr. Burke and Mr. Martin. Is there a like set of suggestions from you, or have you had a chance to review these, or do you
sure.
have comments?
Sure. Mr. Martin, is there, Mr. Burke, any thoughts on the proposed standard changes?
Members, I've gone through them, and the standards are largely a technical document. They were developed by an actuary retained by the commission. As a layman, I can look at these, but I don't have the same level of expertise that would allow me to review them in the same fashion that Ms. Beckham does. So we've relied largely on their technical changes. The other grammatical cleanup review changes make eminent good sense.
Is there anybody here who wants to be heard on proposed changes? Any interested parties or the funds want to weigh in? Go ahead.
Hi. Mr. Chair, Dave Bergstrom, the director of the Minnesota State Retirement System. I did get a chance to review them, the new standards, relatively quickly, and for most of them, I think they're technical, and I think many of them are good suggestions. I would like to have an opportunity to discuss them with our actuary, much as Mr. Martin relies on your actuary. We would like to have the opportunity to do the same. I think some of them will add costs that we just need to know and budget for, and not that we're against doing them, but I just need to know the implications. I also want to make sure I understand exactly what some of the changes in respect to, like, projection valuations, and make sure there are no unintended consequences. For example, I think one of the recommendations is to do a projection for all of the retirement plans. We administer an elective officer's plan and a legislator's plan where it's not funded. So you're going to go from zero to zero. And, you know, some of the things just don't necessarily work, or they may not be cost effective for some of the smaller plans that we administer. So I think most of these are very good recommendations. I do agree with Milliman's last recommendation, and what would be nice is to have an opportunity for the directors and our actuary and Milliman to get together to make sure everybody understands what the changes would be, and reach a consensus on the best way to proceed.
I'm guessing, again, most of them would be adopted, but I just want to make sure we know all of the implications before we move ahead.
Well, I don't know how long this particular proposal has been available. You know, if we have to have another meeting of the Pensions Commission, I'll be happy to call it. But as we get later in the summer and the fall, it's going to be harder and harder to get people in here. And so we're probably looking at the start of the 2011 session. So is it possible we could adopt this? I mean, I'm interested in your feedback, but is it possible we could adopt this and then revisit some issues that if your actuaries have any concerns about it? I don't know. I mean,
Mr. Chair, my sense, and I believe this was just made available
yesterday.
Okay.
And so
I got it in the mail last week. So
yeah.
Okay.
And if it was sent earlier, I don't know, but my impression, or that's the first that I was aware of it, and I have not had an opportunity to check with our actuary, and I certainly understand where you're coming from, but from what I am seeing in that, knowing how much some of the projections we did, for you this year, I think we would be very willing to come back and give you some of what is here, if that would be helpful, rather than making it a requirement. But I have some concerns about some of it, and I would like an opportunity to talk to our actuary.
Okay. Ms. Vanek?
Mr. Chair, members, I concur with Mr. Bergstrom. We increased our budget to do the study that was required by statute this year, and if we have to add on to that or modify it, we need to understand the implications of that and report that back to our board. And I agree with Mr. Bergstrom. Most of these changes, or maybe all of them, are very reasonable changes for us to all better understand our plans and what's going on. But I need to know that our actuary fully understands what's being asked for and what it's going to cost us.
Okay, any questions, Ms. Hacking?
Nothing really to add except to say that the valuation modeling that Ms. Beckham referred to is not really new for us. We started doing that in 2007 with the post fund because it was facing some problems. We used projections pretty extensively with that, and then once the post fund was merged with the active fund, you saw this valuation modeling in a lot of the materials that we gave you last year in preparation for the big study. You may recall those multicolored lines that showed what would happen to our fund if nothing was changed, and then what would happen under optimistic assumptions and or pessimistic assumptions. So that information is something we plan to prepare again for this coming year, because given our financial status, it's important to stay on top of that. So it's not brand new to us, but we think it does make sense that you and we get that information on a more regular basis.
Ms. Beckham, what would happen if the commission did not act at this time? In coming off of the election, there's the House and the Senate are going to have to make appointments to the Pension Commission. That might not happen until maybe February. 4 years ago, it was March before we even had the Pension Commission appointed. So I'm just trying to figure out what kind of timeline do you have to get these standards approved?
Well, I think that there's one issue, perhaps in my mind, that might be more pressing than the rest of them. I think issues like the valuation model, if that can't be accommodated until the 2011 valuation, I think that's fine. To the extent that there's going to be some modeling done for the defined contribution option, that may provide us with insight on the baseline costs anyway. The one issue that came up in our audit of the valuation last year is the decrement timing. When we have an assumption, when are people assumed to leave, retire, terminate, die? Our understanding is that the mid-year was intended to be middle of the plan year, or Jan 1, and if I remember correctly, I think that Mercer's valuation is doing it July 1. So if the current standards remain, there is at least some question whether those valuations comply with the standards. where I think what we anticipated with the change in that particular area was that it would be clarified, and then if an exception needed to be made, the commission could approve that, and that would clear that one item up. Other than that, I don't see any reason that these changes need to be implemented right now. I don't believe they'll have much of an impact on the 2010 valuations, and as I said, there was very complete information on market value of assets versus actuarial in the last valuation. I would assume that Mercer would continue with that in the 2010 valuation.
Well, I'm thinking that if the funds desire to have their actuaries take a look at this before we take final action, I'm certainly amenable to that. I'm just thinking that I don't know July and August. I mean, people, it's hard to get people in. And once we get past Labor Day, I think people who have campaigns, which does not include Senator Rosen, but she's got a free ride. But it is going to be difficult to bring people in. I'm thinking we might have to think about if we have another meeting, it might be, mid-November or something like that, early December. I mean, we'd still be here as a pension commission. We'll a lame duck pension commission maybe, but we'll be there. I'll work with staff and we'll just be in touch with you. I don't know that it's necessarily to have Milliman come back for that. Is it? Would you have to be here for us? Unless it's significant changes for that. So.
And I would just make a comment on the timing of, if you don't meet until November, it could be that the July 1, 2010 valuations are already completed or nearly complete. So it would be difficult to incorporate changes in the actuarial standards in the current year's valuation. Just a thought.
So give me some advice. Should we, how long do the funds need to have your actuaries take a look at this?
Mr. Chair, in talking to our actuary, they would think a week would be sufficient to look at it. I understand the difficulty in coming back. Another approach that, if you're willing to kind of trust us, we could reach agreement on just a few things and put that in the valuation or provide it to you and then go from there, too. But otherwise, a week would be sufficient. And I don't mean to be an obstacle here. I just need to know what the budget implications are.
Yeah, it's reasonable. Same wish.
Mr. Chair, I think it's very reasonable to allow them some time, and I'm pleased to see some of the suggestions that are being made, particularly the experience study for some of our more specific groups. I'm thinking of the para police and fire and the correctional groups. I know oftentimes if I'm in discussions in my district about pension issues, that there are always we tend to think of kind of the larger three groups. There are idiosyncrasies that fall within this commission, and those are often the ones that are the most misunderstood, at least in my district. And so, I think there's a lot of good stuff in here. So I'd like to afford you the time. And for the record, Mr. Chair, I just want to make it very clear. Your comment about the lame duck commission made me extremely nervous. And for the record, I have every intention of returning here.
So do I. But the fact of the matter is, once elections happen, there'll be a new legislature. Changes happen. I hope everybody returns, but there's no guarantees. But what I'm thinking about doing is having just another meeting in August.
Speaking of the Senate.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Senator Rosen is guaranteed. Okay. No, we talked about this. Write-in campaign. Watch out for the write-ins. Okay. But let's meet in August sometime. We'll just have to take a poll of the commission members and find out when you're available and go from there. So we'll give you an opportunity, but we do want to take a vote on this thing so we can get this thing moving here. So
the 11th.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sounds good. Okay.
11th of August.
Yeah, after the primary. Okay. After the primary.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And and again, most of these I think are great ideas, and we would agree with them.
So. Okay. Anything else? Does anybody else want to be heard on this before we move on to the next item? Okay. Okay. The last item that we've got on the agenda deals with the defined contribution study that was in the 2010 pensions bill. And we have a summary of the 2010 pension bill. We're not going to go through the bill. We've had a lot of fun with that one. So, but there was that study, and the funds asked for a little bit of time to kind of get some guidance and thoughts on where they're going on it. They have a one-page handout in here. Mr. Bergstrom, did you want to kind of discuss what your thoughts are, and we can give you some feedback as appropriate?
Mr. Chair, no. Okay. Respectfully, Mr. Okay. Chair, no.
Sure. Ms. Hacking?
I'm the
designated. Ms. Hacking has been volunteered to do
sure,
this,
okay.
So at least start off. So.
Okay.
Just working from the one pager, we reprinted there kind of what the statute says. It asks the directors to jointly conduct a study of defined benefit, defined contribution, and other alternative retirement plans for our public employees. And you ask that the study include analysis of feasibility, sustainability, financial impacts, and other design considerations. And this is due back to you no later than June 1, 2011. So we want to go over briefly how we are approaching this and really solicit your feedback and guidance if you have any for us at this time. What we're planning to do is to identify a number of options, retirement plan options, and describe their advantages and disadvantages. The intent of this report is not to give you any recommendations, but really just provide you with analysis to help you make informed decisions down the road. We do see that there will be an actuarial piece to this. We expect to be asking our actuary to do some analysis of what the financial impact might be of some of these options. And we think that perhaps once that analysis is done, you may want to have Milliman look it over just to kind of give you assurance that it's a reasonable study.
Well, and that part, I'm not quite sure because we haven't budgeted for that part yet. So we better just let's do one step at a time. But I don't know that we can assume that that's going to happen.
Right, and that's optional.
Yeah.
It's certainly mm-hmm. whatever you think is advisable. We do want to solicit input and comments from our various stakeholder groups and any other interested parties. We are intending to circulate a draft outline of the study and to our stakeholder groups at an early point. Actually, we're planning a meeting in mid-September for that purpose. Then we expect to hold a second stakeholder meeting in January 2011 because at that point we'll have our valuation data available and we'd be able to give the stakeholder groups a status update. We would then intend to finish a draft, a kind of a first draft, preliminary draft of the report by March. Circulate it to the various interested groups for their comment and input. We would actually be asking people to give us comments and writings, which then we would intend to incorporate as an appendix to the report itself. So if you could turn the page on the back side, this is just a rough outline, kind of a table of contents of what the report would look like. Obviously, executive summary introduction. The number three is to describe our current systems or benefit structure just at a very basic level, key member demographics, and what our current actuarial status is, and including in that would be a discussion of our investment program and what our historical rates of return have been. Then we would describe the main retirement plan options, DB, DC, a hybrid DB, DC, and cash balance program, which is a hybrid of sorts, but we would try to describe and define those particular options. Then the next section is to look at the advantages and disadvantages of each of those design options, and we listed there some of the criteria that we would use to come up with those advantages and disadvantages, and that's a list of categories that we expect to add to, you know, as we have more interaction with stakeholder groups and do our research. The next chapter would just be to talk about the public safety plans because there are some unique considerations with those plans that perhaps don't lend themselves very well to defined contribution arrangements, so that chapter would be to discuss that. Next area would be to incorporate any written comments we get from outside groups. And we foresee a fairly big appendix treating various subjects like what's going on in other states, what's going on in the private sector, retirement income security studies, and things that are relevant to this topic. So that's our plan, and again, we'd appreciate any suggestions or guidance you have.
Well, I certainly agree that the study should not just assume an outcome, because the legislature is going to make a decision or no decision, and we just don't know what's going to happen down the road. But I think if you give us various options saying, well, if you do this, these are some of the considerations. If you do that, here are some other ones. If you do nothing, here are some considerations. I think that there's, for instance, you know, you may very well say, well, if you want to offer defined contribution as an option for an employee, I mean, it will still have the defined contribution plans, defined benefit plans, but if somebody wants to take this as an option, you know, here are some things, it's going to be minimal impact. But if you do decide that you're going to close out a fund and then put everybody in the future in defined contribution, well, here's what you better start thinking about, because like we just saw with MRF, at some point down the road, you're going to have a closed fund with a lot of retirees in there, and what's that going to mean 30 years from now? What are the short-term costs? What are the long-term benefits and so forth? So I think a lot of these things are just going to have to be fleshed out, but you know, the more options you can provide to this commission or the legislature, I think the better idea we'd get a handle on, you know, this whole topic area. So. Other thoughts that members may have on going forward with this study here? Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hacking, one comment, one suggestion. Comment, you reference a number of times that you're going to solicit input and comments from the various stakeholder groups throughout the process, and I just want to underscore the importance of doing that along the way. I think that will be very helpful and important. And frankly, when it comes to June 1st, 2011, it would be my desire that whatever you come up with in your report wouldn't necessarily be a surprise to any of those stakeholder groups, and frankly, would not be a surprise to this commission. Suggestion that I have is, we, particularly in the 2010 session, made some modifications to our plans. And we made those modifications because we were trying to foresee and be responsible in the long run. I think that it might be instructive or a good reminder here, not only for the commission, but for members of the public, to be able to see in a concise way the more recent changes or modifications that have been made to those plans. Because I fear that without doing that, that we will forget the many conversations and the work that transpired leading up to the 2010 session, and there will be this inference that we have done nothing. And we all know in this room that that's not the case, but I think that within this report, perhaps there's room for a segment that would address that.
Okay. Anything else? Is there anybody else who's here who wants to give us some ideas or suggestions on the study before we get going on it? Okay. I don't have anything else. Members and staff, there's going to be a reception, I think, at the retirement building on Empire Drive in shortly after, about 15 minutes or so. So recognition for all the work that we've done in the last year. So you're invited there. So anything else before the commission? If not, as I say, we'll meet probably in August and see what's on the agenda then. So Ms. Vanek.
I just wanted to assure the commission that we have a smooth transition of MRF to PARA. Mm-hmm. Thanks to Dave DeYoung, our assistant director, working very closely with the MRF staff. We successfully moved their computer systems to our office a day before checks had to be cut. Checks were cut, and everything went smoothly. And the legislation you enacted called for the two finance folks at MRF to come to PARA if they so chose, and the one benefit administrator to go to the city. Well, in fact, the two finance folks chose not to come to PERA, but the benefits administrator, we were able to create a position, and she accepted the position, and the calls we have received have been very positive. Thank you for bringing her. She is the face and the voice of MRF to these people, and I've asked her to join us this afternoon so you could meet her.
Oh, that's nice.
One of the other things that we may want to look at next month, if we have the information, as you may know, there was a lawsuit, that a class action lawsuit filed immediately after the bill was signed by the governor, basically saying that we can't take away some benefits from the retirees. It's my understanding that the complaint has been amended. We may not know much about it, but maybe we want to just get a kind of a quick briefing on just, you know, where that is. I doubt that that issue would be resolved within the next year or 2 years or something. I mean, this could be a while before. But we may want to just find out just where that thing is sitting. So we'll have at least something else to talk about next month. Sarah Rosen.
Mr. Chair, you'll throw a few dates out in August for us, right?
Right. We're going to find out who's available and when. I recognize that it's a vacation time for folks. We'll just have to see when people are available, and that's when we'll come on in. So, okay? We'll check with you. I'll come up with about three different dates and just see what works for people. So, okay, if there's nothing coming before the commission, have a good July. See you later.
Thank you. Great. See you later. All right.
Okay.
How are you doing?
Always something else.
Nice.